Hello, dear friends, listeners, comrades. This is episode 65 of the Alexi Sale podcast. My name is Talal, just coming in with a quick message at the tippity top of the show. Thank you so much for your love and outreach about our Christmas episode. Hope you enjoyed it. It was fun putting Alexi through that ridiculous survey. My health is almost back at peak form. I'm nearly cured. Thank you for all the love and care. I just wanted to tell you before this episode, which is a really cool conversation between Alexi Sale and Andrew Feinstein, that this was actually filmed in Alexi's living room, and the full video version of this is available on the YouTube. So if you're listening to this on your favorite podcast app, head over to the YouTube and watch the video version if you like, or just enjoy the audio version. And of course, like I said last episode, I'm going to do my best wherever possible from now on. Any episode that we record, I'm going to have video versions available on our Patreon, because we record them on a program or on a website called Zencaster, which records the video and the audio. You know, it's a bit of extra work, but subscriptions to the Patreon are steadily increasing. Thank you very much. I think you deserve a treat. So head over to patreon.com/AlexiSalePodcast and sign up if you haven't already. You know, buy us like a packet of mints a month. I'm sick of saying buy us a coffee a month. A potted plant every 2 months. You know, something cheap. it's not much. And you'll be able to watch video episodes of the Alexi Sale podcast. patreon.com/AlexiSalePodcast. All right, let's get on with it, shall we? Happy New Year, one and all.
Okay, well, welcome to episode 64 of the Alexi Sale podcast, and we're back to having guests now. And this is a relatively new man in my life, but somebody who's brought me great joy and hope, really, with his insights. And he is Andrew Feinstein. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
Now, so I suppose we might as well start at the beginning, really, with your political journey and then move on through, unless, you know, unless you want to do it differently, really.
No, not at all. So, as you picked up very quickly when we first met, this isn't an English accent. I'm South African by background. I grew up in South Africa. My dad was South African. My mom was Austrian. And my mom, having survived the Holocaust in occupied Vienna, and losing dozens of her family, mainly at Auschwitz, came to South Africa after the war. She met my dad in London after the war, and they went back to South Africa together. And she sort of saw black South Africans being treated like the Jews of Europe had been treated by the Nazis. And she had this notion of never again that, you know, didn't only apply to Jews.
Unfortunately, not something that's shared widely enough, but
Yeah, exactly. And so from a very young age, you know, she worked, she was a puppeteer. She worked in an illegal non-racial theater in Cape Town.
Wow.
So during the holidays, when I was at primary school, I'd have to go along to the theater, and there were all these people hanging around. And I didn't realize at the time, it was only sort of retrospectively, it was people like Athol Fugard, who was our best anti-apartheid playwright. And his actors, John Carney and Winston Chona, and he wrote all of his plays for them specifically.
Right.
They would be hanging around. And a guy who I knew then as Dollar Brand, which I loved the name, became Abdullah Ibrahim, brilliant jazz pianist, who was a youngster then, I mean, older than me, but he would be plonking away on the piano, and I'd get irritated that he wouldn't be playing with me, why he had to be...
This exactly?
This was in Cape Town.
In Cape Town, in a... I mean, was if it was illegal, was it the building, you know, behind a kind of fake door?
Exactly. So how it worked was you had to know where this theater was to be able to get inside it. And even then, as soon as the security police found out, it would get raided, so it would get closed down, they'd open up somewhere else. So it was a sort of literally a moving feast. So through that, you know, unlike the vast, vast majority of white South Africans, I also started, my mom would take me to townships. She was involved with an organization called the Black Sash. So I'd get a sense of African townships and squatter settlements. So I grew up with the sense that this society was just nuts.
Right.
And then landed up first, I had to leave the country in the mid-80s, landed up getting recruited sort of into the ANC underground without realizing it. Which speaks, I suppose, to my complete naivete. I was in a place called Crossroads, which is a huge squatter settlement. 70,000 shacks had just been burned down. And I was there with about 20 other students trying to run a relief operation for the families. And this guy comes up to me and says, "Oh, comrade, you need to come to this meeting later tonight." So I turn up at this meeting. People all had quite strange names, which I didn't realize, but they were all their code names.
Right.
And we sat there for hours and hours waiting for people who were coming into the country to give us advice and instructions. And so, you know, you didn't fill out membership forms, let's put it that way, to a banned illegal organization. And after about a year, I had to do my military service, and I didn't want to do that. And I mean, you never know the truth of these things. I was going to be arrested when I turned up for my military service. So I got out of the country in the 80s, spent time in the US and here, working with the ANC here, and then went back when the ANC was unbanned, and worked as a facilitator in the constitutional negotiations. And then I was in Bangladesh getting married, as most Jewish white South Africans do. When I started getting these messages from people I'd been involved with in various facilitation roles saying, "We thought you were a neutral facilitator, and now you're on the ANC's election list of candidates." The ANC had just forgotten to tell me.
Right.
So I landed up as a member of parliament in South Africa for 7.5 years.
Shit.
Which was extraordinary. You know, the first 4 years when Mandela was really running things, and unbelievable experience that I was very privileged to be a part of.
Yeah.
Went a bit haywire after that when Mbeki took over.
Somewhat, yeah.
Yeah. And then I ran the main financial oversight committee in parliament, the public accounts committee, and revealed a $10 billion arms deal that Mbeki had decided to do because, of course, South Africa faced so many enemies. When we had this awful guy, Nelson Mandela, as our president.
Yeah.
And everyone hated us because we were a non-racial democracy. And, you know, we've...
$10 billion.
$10 billion. And we've barely used the weapons until now.
Yeah. Well.
$350 million of bribes.
Yeah.
So Mbeki, who I'd known a long time from when I'd been in exile, called me in and basically said, "So here's your choice. You can have a glittering political career for as long as you want. I wasn't yet 30. Or this is the day we kick you out of parliament if you don't stop your investigation."
So you left parliament.
And so I resigned the night before they were going to kick me out.
Right.
And I sort of...
Roll back a couple of things there. We were having, it wasn't exactly a discussion really, but I've always had complicated feelings about state sponsorship of the arts. We were talking about this at the end of, and I always often think that people go, "Oh, the Arts Council is, you know, forbidding political." Well, of course they fucking are, you know. I mean, why saddle yourself with this kind of, this organization whose purpose is to neuter you, really? I feel like your mother's puppet theater. This is such a shining example of real political theater, not trying to get grant from some bag in fucking Crocs with a leather bag across his shoulder. You know, but just a proper guerrilla theater, you know, that directly opposes the government.
That's the point. I mean, I think to do political theater, you've got to either do it without money and just make money on the door if you can, which, given you can't advertise properly, is a challenge, but they managed it. They used to raise a lot of money. And then they were lucky in that there were sort of white liberal, some more progressive than that.
Patronage, yeah.
Who'd exactly, yeah. Who'd give them money because they were committed to the politics that the theatre was. And I'll tell you something, between politics and music in South Africa, between theatre and music in South Africa, they had a huge impact in the country.
And I think, coming up to date, that's, you know, two kind of things that Israel has attacked in Gaza is one has been the healthcare system, the other's been the cultural, you know. Culture can be so powerful, I think, and that's why they've destroyed it or tried to.
I mean, culture becomes both a symbol of and a vessel of resistance.
Yeah.
Which is why they've attacked it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's why the big state arts bodies like the Arts Council fund mainly anodyne stuff.
Yeah. Of course. I think they're always great. It's like that, you know, I'm just evolving these theories as I speak, but, you know, there was a big, you know, the CIA was behind abstract expressionism in the United States. You know, the movement of Jackson Pollock and people like that.
Yeah, that I didn't know.
Yeah, they funded because they thought, because the Soviets were pushing this idea of socialist realism, they thought, what we have to push. And so there was a huge CIA funding of both challenging or obscure or elite art, pictorial art, like people like Jackson Pollock, but also particularly poetry. They're all kind of avant-garde poetry in the United States and in Britain, I'm exaggerating slightly, was financed by the CIA, basically. And they had a magazine called Encounter. That was entirely financed by I may be making this up to a degree, but I think, But I wonder whether...
I've never heard that.
Yeah. But I wonder whether part of the kind of Arts Council's kind of patronage of obscurantism isn't also a kind of a deliberate tactic.
Really. Absolutely. Yeah. There's no doubt at all. I saw a very interesting film recently that's made by the same guy who directed the Shadow World film of one of my books, a chap called Johan Grimonprez, a Belgian director. It's called Soundtrack to a Coup d'Etat.
Right.
It's about the assassination of Lumumba.
Right.
And Belgium and America's involvement in it. The thing that was revealed in the film, because there's this extraordinary jazz soundtrack, was that people like Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie, and others were used by the CIA and other American state organizations as a form of soft power in post-independence Africa.
Really?
So they did these trips.
Right.
And there was this sort of very subtle messaging around the trips, around the goodness that America brings to these newly independent states, while they were basically bumping off most popular democratically elected leaders.
Yeah. Well, that brings us back to, we asked you a bit about this, or we've talked about this a little bit. What happens with somebody like Mbeki? Are they always flawed? Do they start out noble and then get corrupted? You know, what happened to the ANC, really, I suppose?
I mean, Mbeki himself's interesting because, you know, he had this very weird upbringing. So his dad, Govan Mbeki, was one of the most important leaders of the South African Communist Party.
Right.
And when he comes off Robben Island, Govan, the dad, after 20 however many years. So Thabo had been sent into exile 16 or so. And he worked as Oliver Tambo's speechwriter based here in London, went to Sussex University. When Govan gets released, and there's this sort of welcome party on the airstrip that they land at, and Thabo is just one of the airstrips, and his dad sort of walks past him, shakes his hand, and walks on as though he's any other comrade.
Right.
And, you know, all sorts of people are saying, oh my gosh, what happened there? Why didn't he, like, embrace him? And so Govan was asked about it, and he said, well, he's just another comrade to me. And, you know, not to get into sort of psychological stuff, but...
Well, but I think we do, because that, you know, I mean, everything that anybody does comes from their psychology, doesn't it? And therefore, we have to look at the psychology of people. I mean, I think that's... I always wonder whether there isn't some sort of... I mean, I think people have attempted a kind of synthesis of Freudianism and Marxism, yeah. You know, which hasn't probably got very far. But
it hasn't.
Partly because Freudianism is deeply flawed. But I mean, you know, I think psychological motivations.
I think there's something in that. But I spent many years studying clinical psychology.
Oh, really?
Trying to stay out of the apartheid military. But in Mbeki's case, there's sort of, he's got a chip on his shoulder.
Right.
And, you know, the whole thing after he took over from Mandela was, I've got to do better than him in the next election. I've got to be friends with Robert Mugabe because Mandela and Mugabe never got on. It was all about, I've got to establish myself for myself. I've got to prove myself. And you think, you know, someone like that, is that really the case? Also, the big issue with Thabo is that, you know, in the early days of the internet, he was notorious. He's one of those people who needed very little sleep.
Right.
And he'd sit with his scotch at night on the internet. And this is how I became an AIDS denialist, is he came across the denialist medical people.
Right.
And he bought into their stuff that HIV doesn't cause AIDS, et cetera, et cetera. But it also fueled quite a lot of his economics, and sadly, he just adopted this nonsense of there is no alternative. So those of us, because I then went on to train in economics and finance, those of us who were trained in economics or finance, the places we were sent to prepare for government would be, you know, the IMF and the World Bank, the Treasury in Washington, here.
Same old neoliberal shit.
Exactly. Yeah. And he really bought into that in a big, big way. And so that was the first problem, where it was entirely the wrong recipe for South Africa at that conjuncture, even if you think it could ever be the right recipe. But particularly, you know, we had this like huge population of unemployed people who had very few skills.
Right.
And you can build an economy by training those people and building demand by increasing those people's income. And you do an enormous amount for their lives generally, and we went exactly the opposite route.
Right.
We had to remove all protections on local industries because we were going to get all this great foreign direct investment. We had to bring our debt levels down radically. And of course, the foreign direct investment didn't materialize.
Yeah.
And the South African economy today, we have an official unemployment rate of 37%. It's probably actually more like 50%. And we still haven't seen the wrongs of our ways. So, you know, to go back to your question, are people like this, are they flawed? Do they have the right intentions? I mean, Mbeki's smart, obviously committed. And there were many people of huge quality in the ANC when we went into government.
Yeah.
And it was so quickly corrupted after Mandela stood down because Mbeki thought that corruption, if it served the party, was totally acceptable. And the whole purpose of that arms deal, the ANC had no money.
Right.
And senior executives from the world's arms companies came to the negotiations before our 94 election and whispered in Mbeki's ears, in a guy called Joe Modise's ears, he was our first democratically elected defense minister, and said, not only is this a great way to keep the white generals happy, because you're giving them toys to play with, basically, this is the way to fund your political party on the bribes. And that's what happened.
I mean, they're not wrong, I suppose, that, you know, the white generals were a threat, I suppose. I mean, and the other thing that we talked about before as well is, of course, the greatest leaders murdered, aren't they? Like Patrice Lumumba, like Fred Hampton, you know.
Of course.
That's the other thing they do, isn't it? So the best, the ones that show real incorruptibility are killed, and
Absolutely. It's like people often say to me now, you know, taking those situations to dealing with the present, where is Palestine's Mandela? Mm-hmm. I hear all the time.
Yeah.
And I have to say to people, either murdered by the Israeli state, or in an apartheid jail in Israel.
Yeah.
And there's not one Mandela. There are dozens of them. The point is, if there is real resistance, if there is a real alternative, which I think you and I believe there is, if they're people who could realize that alternative, they've got to get rid of them.
Yeah.
Because it threatens the entire system.
And that's something we have to, you know.
Yeah.
We have to admit that possibility, yeah. I think, really, and guard against it. So, okay, so where are we now? You've been thrown out of government. Did you have a car and an office and shit like that?
So I'll never forget when you say that. As you know, my wife's from Bangladesh. Yeah. While I was in government, I went to Bangladesh and I spoke at the parliament about the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. Afterwards, I had this group of MPs talking to me. No questions about the TRC. The questions were, so when you became an MP, how many cars did you get? How many houses did you get? What business are you in? And when I sort of said, well, I have my house that I live in, but that's my own house. Didn't get a car. Used to ride to Parliament on a motorized scooter. And I don't have any business interests because I think it would be a conflict of interest. They completely ignored me. And instead, in Bangladeshi, in Bangla, they said to Simon, my wife, what are you doing with this Muppet? So I'm afraid. Well, I'm not afraid. It's a good thing. There was none of that.
Yeah. Well, good.
So, you know, we had bought a house in Cape Town. And I had my scooter and we had a car because we had a little kid. And we came to the UK, supposedly for 2 years. A lot of Simon's family are here. So we came to London so I could write my first book, which was about that arms deal and what it had done to the ANC. Book called After the Party. 23 years later, we're still here.
You're still here. Tell us about your life since then, really, I suppose. Bring us up to date.
Well, one thing I can tell you about it very quickly. The fucking weather hasn't changed in those 23 years.
It's good.
I mean, yes. It drives me nuts. 23 years and I'm still not used to the weather. I miss Cape Town a lot. I really do. But so what I've done since then.
Well, can I just say to the podcast, apart from social justice, I think we should guarantee that under socialism, that the weather will be better.
No, absolutely.
I'm prepared to make that commitment now.
We've got to make reasonable promises we know we can fulfill under socialism. So there we go.
That isn't possible.
The weather will be perfect forever.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be lovely every day.
So at first on the South African arms deal, I thought we were just naive. You know, none of us expected to be in government. We were all activists and people had sacrificed huge amounts. And then we all land up in Parliament. And I thought these arms companies have just taken us for a ride.
That's an interesting point. As you just mentioned, aside, that people have given up huge amounts. And you think that makes people think sometimes that they're owed.
Exactly. Yeah. That happened a lot, sadly.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of your first question. Yeah. Is people felt they were entitled.
Yeah.
They'd lived lives where they had nothing materially. And this was the time where they were entitled. And that's very sad. But I suppose, you know, we've seen it in a lot of struggles that has happened. So I started writing this first book and I started looking into the various European arms companies that were involved, led by BAE Systems, of course. And Tony Blair only made 3 trips to South Africa to sell this deal to make sure BAE got a contract. BAE didn't even make the technical shortlist for the contract they were bidding for. Their price was more than double the plane that the South African Air Force actually wanted. But 3 of the 6 cabinet ministers who made the decisions about what we bought and from whom were bribed.
Right.
And Tony Blair made 3 trips to facilitate that. And I realized that what had happened in South Africa happens all over the world all the time, that we weren't particularly naive or stupid and duped, that we're all basically being duped by these arms companies. So at the time that the South African deal was done, in which BAE paid £115 million of bribes to win a contract they should never have won, Blair and BAE were doing 6 or 7 other deals elsewhere in the world.
famously the Al Yamama contract.
Exactly.
In Saudi Arabia.
And I'll exclude Al Yamama for a moment because of how insanely big that was. But on those six or seven other deals at the same time, paying over £1 billion of bribes, because that's how BAE does business. The Al Yamama deal, which Thatcher had done, which is why Blair was such a Thatcherite, because he fitted into that sort of arms-selling neoliberal mode like that. On that deal, which was also called the Who's Yamama deal, because Mark Thatcher was paid £12 million on the deal for nothing, just given £12 million, probably because his mom just didn't want to have to fund this wastrel son for the rest of her life. They paid £6 billion of bribes on that deal alone. £6 billion of bribes. So, you know, as I came to discover this stuff, when my first book came out, I started getting contacted by people because no one writes about this stuff. The last book before, a book of mine called The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade, the last book on the global trade before then came out in 1979.
Really? Because it is, I mean, this is the word, you know, the head of NATO today is saying we should be in a wartime mindset, which means we buy a shit ton more weapons. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's important to understand, which, you know, you do. We've spoken about this before. The thing about it, it's the most corrupt trade of all, because it all happens behind a veil of national security imposed secrecy. But a lot of the bribes find their way back into our political system in Britain.
Right.
So when the Al Yamama deal happens, or any of these other dodgy deals, some of the money through the intermediaries gets back into our political parties, the two main political parties, except when Jeremy Corbyn was leader of Labour, obviously, and Michael Foot, I suppose.
Yeah.
They weren't throwing a whole lot of money at Michael Foot's Labour Party either. And then individual politicians, you know, Tony Blair leaves office, has made, in my very conservative estimation, over £110 million personally, just from the companies that benefited from the invasion of Iraq, and his association with BAE Systems.
And of course, famously, I mean, it pollutes our judiciary in that Blair personally stopped the serious fraud office investigating the Al Yamama deal.
Absolutely.
You know, which corrupts. I mean, what's the difference between us and, you know,
Jacob Zuma, South Africa's former president, who stole one third of our GDP every year he was in office, in what we call state capture. I'm supposed to be a witness in his corruption trial when that ever happens. But exactly, this is, you know, in the UK, it's just a slightly more refined version.
Yeah, we think we're different and we're not,
absolutely not. You know, where does all Zuma and everybody else's corruption come from? Countries like Britain and the US and France and Germany, and because you need two to tango when it comes to corruption. And boy, does Britain tango.
Muchas gracias. So, you write this book, and then you become
So I write this book, and then all these people from prosecutors' offices, from militaries, from defense companies, from governments start approaching me with information, saying, "Oh my goodness, somebody is interested in this stuff."
And they're people who are unhappy with the.
They're people who are watching this corrupt industry take place before their eyes, seeing their countries corrupted, seeing the rule of law corrupted, seeing this, you know, exactly what you were talking about. This, we're constantly a threat. We should be in a constant state of war readiness. Because how else do you increase your defense budget?
Yeah.
And if you don't increase the defense budgets, you're not selling more weapons, so they're not bribes that circulate back into the political process. And it's people who are just, you've seen this, who are fed up with it. I mean, one of the guys who was a Pentagon whistleblower, when I met with him, he says to me, "You've got to understand, the American military-industrial complex is like a self-licking ice cream. This is the perfect business model. You know, they give money to candidates.
Yeah.
The candidates get elected. They then give billion-dollar contracts back to the people who fund their political careers.
Yeah.
And in the U.S., that's legal. It's a system of legalized bribery. Here it's not, but we still do it."
Yeah.
And that's the difference. So with all of this information, I then wrote the second book called The Shadow World, Exposing the Trade Globally. And that was made into a documentary. Then I've written subsequent stuff to that, all based on the arms trade. The latest one as you know, co-edited with, amongst others, Jeremy Corbyn.
Sitting here on my couch.
Called Monstrous Anger of the Guns, How the Global Arms Trade Ruins the World and What We Can Do About It. And so this is, and I suppose I investigate this stuff because it's a great window onto just how crappy our politics are.
Yes.
Because this is like, because it's all secretive, they do what they really want to do in everything, but can only do it in this trade.
Because right. It's slightly more out in the open if it's food stuff. So, you know, I mean, it's still the same shit, but it's...
No, it's the same shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's easier for journalists, if we had any journalists interested in investigations.
Yeah.
It's easier for journalists to investigate and expose, whereas this isn't. And if it lands up in court, as you suggested, then they either just cut it down. They say national security, which is what Blair did to close down the Al-Yamama investigation.
Yeah.
And it really is a way of exposing the reality of our politics. And I suppose through that, I've sort of found myself more involved in British and global politics than I ever expected to be.
Well, tell us about that and bring us up to date on your foray into the...
Well, it's all your fault, actually. So, you know, I served in Parliament, as I said, for 7.5 years, and it was an extraordinary time. The end was a bit shitty, obviously. Not nice when your comrades are describing you as a traitor because you're washing the dirty laundry in public, which constitutionally was what I was supposed to do. But in where we both live, in Camden, a lot of local people really didn't want to vote for Keir Starmer in the last election. We've had him as an MP for almost 10 years now. And to put it politely, a lot of people don't really like him.
No. I mean, this is people who, yeah.
So
I mean, the public who don't know him don't like him, but
yeah.
There's people like us who do know him, we dislike him even more. He's a particularly dislikable person, I think.
It is. I find it astonishing because, you know, South Africans, we're sort of generally, you know, you can't walk along the street in South Africa without greeting everyone, asking how they are, et cetera, et cetera. So people generally get on. You come here and to see someone who is now prime minister of the country, totally incapable of even the sort of the basics of human interaction.
Yes.
It's quite something.
Yeah.
It really is. So, you know, as you know, people in the local community started talking about standing an independent candidate against him. And they try to persuade you.
They did. I'm uniquely unqualified for that role, I think.
Which is why we all wanted you to do it.
Yeah.
Because it would have been so great having you basically laughing at him for an entire election campaign in very smart, witty ways, as your poem did. Now imagine you could have run an entire campaign based on that poem.
Indeed, yeah.
And then we really looked because I thought, you know, okay, so we can't get, you know, the fairly aged, if you don't mind me saying so, bald comic. Let's go for the also aged, bald former politician. Didn't seem to me like the smartest strategic move. At least the comic has a way with words.
Yes.
And I thought, you know, the guy doesn't have to have a beard and no hair. It's not compulsory to stand against Keir Starmer. And we really looked hard to try and find a good local candidate. And there were a few, I must tell you. I tried to persuade. There was a young Palestinian doctor working in the NHS who I tried to persuade, and they just wouldn't go for it. So at the end of the day, it was me who landed up doing it. And it was quite an experience, I have to say. It was made a lot easier by yourself, by many in the local community, because I think the strength of feeling about Starmer really came out.
Mm.
And unfortunately, the rest of the country didn't really listen to us.
No.
But we managed to halve his vote.
Which is unprecedented, isn't it? There's never been an...
No one has ever gone into Downing Street having seen their own personal majority reduced, let alone halved.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the count, he was really shocked when he saw the result. And almost, I mean, and we're talking a couple of thousand here, almost as many people in his own constituency voted against him as voted for him.
Yeah.
And that tells you a lot.
Yeah.
But it was a really great experience, not only because I got to know a lot more people in the community that I've lived in for 23 years, but because there was an energy and enthusiasm about it, and also because, you know, going around, especially to the estates, to those big blocks around Camden, people were shocked that someone seeking election actually wanted to talk to them.
Yes.
And for me, that was probably the most important thing about the election, is that, you know, either myself, if it was me personally, or one of our many, many volunteers would say to them, don't you think the person seeking your vote should actually chat to you about what you would want from a representative? And so many people would say, some people would say, I don't even know who my MP is, never seen the person, whoever it is, don't know who my councillors are. And that's what's become of our so-called democracy, I suppose.
Yeah, if it ever, yeah, if it, I mean, I don't know if it was different, but it certainly isn't now. So this, as so that experience of me not standing, I think, which is probably, I still believe was the correct choice, has propelled you into carrying on with this thing, really. I mean, I don't know how much you can talk about. I mean, I find talking to you that the ideas that you have about how the left can progress seem so refreshing compared to the kind of constant failed attempts of, you know.
You know, to be honest with you, and I feel almost bad saying this because I am an interloper. I mean, I just sort of turn up 23 years ago. And, you know, I'm involved in South African politics.
Right.
I've got to at some point give evidence against a former president. I do a lot of South African media. But as a consequence of that, I come from a different politics.
Right.
When, you know, before our first democratic election in South Africa, we did in across the country what we called people's forums. And, you know, we're talking about not schmucks like me as the candidates. We're talking about people like Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, Mbeki. I mean, extraordinary, extraordinary human beings. And you'd think, okay, they'll go around the country lecturing people. They did exactly the opposite. They had people's forums where they just sat and listened.
Right. Yeah.
And they kept on saying to people, there's a lot to do. 340 plus years of racist oligarchy. There's a bit of repair work to do. We're not going to be able to do it quickly. You're not going to get all the things you need immediately. I, of course, was frustrated by that because I was like, we needed 63% for me to get in on the parliamentary list. And I said, I don't say that. This is an election. To say, oh, we're going to do everything because otherwise I'm going to be unemployed in a few weeks' time. But they were quite right doing what they did. And I come here, and as I say, I feel a bit bad saying this, but it almost feels to me like the left have got so used to losing that they're okay with it.
Yes, absolutely. That's so true, I think,
And I'm a very impatient person.
Yeah.
And while, you know, the differences between South Africa and Britain are profound, there are some similarities in terms of the way politics is conducted. We have a billionaire president now, who really used to be a trade unionist, has no interest in the majority of people, just as we have a former human rights lawyer as prime minister, who doesn't seem to have a shred of humanity in him.
And no.
Seems very uninterested in anyone, unless you're a billionaire or a senior executive in a huge corporation.
Well, I think at his core, he believes that's what the Trilateral Commission that he was the only MP as a member of believes in not democracy, don't they? They believe in technocratic government, that the public are too stupid to be involved in their own governance, and then therefore they should be dictated to by these benign, you know,
exactly,
technocrats.
And also they want to be a part of it because they think the people who should be ruling the world are the Elon Musks, Peter Thiels, Donald Trumps, et cetera, these people who supposedly are such geniuses at making money.
Yeah.
What they're geniuses at is turning public money, our money, tax money, into private profit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And drives me to distraction. But so my sort of approach is a very simple one. And it's been amazing, actually, to me that a number of the prominent independents who stood. And of course, we shouldn't forget, you know, that Britain now has 5 independent MPs.
Our media never comments on that, but it's game changing.
Of course.
Yeah.
In the 55 years before this, we've had a total of 2.
Yeah.
So it really is a huge thing. And huge credit, not just to Jeremy, who's around the corner and who clearly has been such a good constituency MP that despite everything the Labour Party has thrown at him, he still wins the election to represent Islington because he actually represents the people of his constituency, unlike the vast majority of our MPs, some of whom probably still have difficulty finding their constituency geographically.
Yeah.
But my way of thinking is people in the UK are just fed up with politics and political parties. So the way to build from the real mess we're in is not to just create another political party.
A top-down kind of centralist party, yeah.
Is to build it from our communities, from the grassroots, to build structures and organizations that really empower people at a local level to deal with the issues. So, you know, in Camden, like in most of the UK, housing is in crisis. No affordable houses are being built. In fact, they're being knocked down to make way for luxury apartments, for more retail space, and, you know, for corporate offices. I mean, you'll remember we spoke during the campaign. The Camden Council gives £1.5 million to Google to build a new head office right next to the Camden Council offices. While, you know, people living on estates wait years for the most basic repair to be done and don't have enough space and have all sorts of shit in their daily lives because of the quality of their housing. Let's work with those people to empower them to demand of the council what is rightfully theirs. Decent housing, where repairs get done, where the council responds to them because they are the vast majority of the people the council's supposed to represent. And because I've been in a situation, you know, because I had to stay out of the army, I have loads of degrees. I learned very quickly in South Africa, working in townships and squatter settlements, that there is very little relationship between degrees and intelligence.
Absolutely, yes.
And I found in those communities who, let's not forget, liberated themselves. Imperfect liberation, but liberated themselves. There is more wisdom. There are more smarts in those communities than I will ever have. And I think that's the problem of politics, is that the people who rise to the top in politics think somehow they're special, that they're better than everyone else.
Yeah. In fact, they're worse.
Often they're a lot worse. Vaclav Havel once said, now I didn't agree with a lot of his politics, but he was a very interesting guy who I was very lucky to speak to just by telephone, not long before he died, because what was then still Czechoslovakia after he became president was done by another one of these huge deals that Blair and BAE Systems were involved in. And he said to me, you know, politics requires the most moral in our society, because I didn't realize just how much power and how many resources you have access to.
Yeah.
He says, but because of that power and because of those resources, the opposite happens. The least moral in our societies are attracted to politics.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a lot of like the press saying, you know, with all these, why are we going on about Angela Rayner's clothes or Starmer's glasses, because this is a window into their own personal lack of morality.
Exactly. Yeah. The fact that they think that other people should pay for whatever they've decided they need.
Yeah.
And they don't understand why people aren't okay with that, which reflects nothing more than just how totally out of touch they've become.
Yeah.
And it's Starmer last year, when he was still leader of the opposition, was probably forced, much against his will, to have a holiday with his family in the UK. Okay. So they went off to a beach in Wales somewhere. This was not a very expensive holiday. He would have far preferred, I'm sure, to have been in Italy or Spain or wherever they normally go. So he's taking a hit here anyway. He gets some little van hire company to pay for his holiday.
Really?
And you just think to yourself, what is wrong with these people? You know, the guy's probably a millionaire anyway. I mean, he's been a very successful lawyer. He's been director of public prosecutions, where, by the way, he didn't allow any agent of the British state to ever be prosecuted for anything. And he has to get, you know, probably cost him, I don't know, $5,000 or something. I mean, how much more could a holiday on in a beach in Wales cost you? But he has to get someone else to pay for him.
Yes.
It's just a warped, warped morality.
Yeah.
And it comes back, and this is why Jeremy has proved so enduringly popular, despite what the media, the Labour Party, and everyone else has tried to do to him. Because he's just a normal, humble bloke.
And the lowest claimant of expenses in Parliament, in all the history of Parliament.
Which makes them think he probably has mental health issues.
That he's not, he's not on the gravy train.
And this is the problem of politics. And I'll tell you something, to go back to where we started, these people need to learn a bit of humility and need to understand their own privilege. And I can only say that now because I'm a privileged person. Yeah, I grew up white in apartheid South Africa. How more privileged can you get, for goodness sake? I was so lucky that I had an experience at that meeting where I was sort of recruited into the underground without realizing it. We sat there for hours waiting for these guys who are coming to give us instructions. And I don't know any of this. I don't know how this all works. I didn't even realize this was a meeting of the ANC. And I'm the only white person there. And what do I do? After sitting there for about 2.5 hours with nothing happening, I say, comrades, I'm just going to pop home, have a quick shower, put on some clean clothes, have something to eat. I'll see you in about an hour. And the guy sitting next to me says, oh, so the Mlungu, the white man, the Mlungu's going home to his nice white suburb to have a nice hot shower and then to get his mommy to cook him a nice hot meal, and then he'll put on his fancy clothes, and then he'll deign to come back, and we'll all be sitting here still stinking in our own sweat. And I'll tell you something, to this day, whenever I think about that, I still feel mortified and embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
But if it taught me one thing in life, it's to understand and be aware of one's own privilege.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the vast, vast majority of our politicians all over the world, I wish we could say Britain was exceptionally bad, but it's everywhere.
They think they deserve it. They think they've earned it. They're entitled.
So weird.
Yeah.
So,
So where are you now? What's happening?
You know, during the election, and don't think I'm ever going to forgive you, I did say to people that this wasn't just going to be an election campaign, because we did, through the campaign, a lot of people locally got energized. And I said to people, the purpose of the campaign is to show the residents of Holborn and St. Pancras that politics can be done differently. And that regardless of the outcome, we're going to continue to do that. So we're setting up something called the Camden Community Alliance. And the purpose is just to work with the organizations that exist in Camden, some of which are just amazing, to look at where there are gaps, to empower local communities in Camden to deal with the crises that they face in healthcare, in housing, in education, in relation to benefits, public transport, all of the things that we know about. And we really are in the process of trying to figure out with the community how to do this in the most democratic, coherent way possible. And we haven't quite figured it out yet. And I don't have a problem with that because I think these things do take time, and you've, especially if they're going to be inclusive. But we're going to figure it out.
This will, this alliance will also have a part. I mean, it will also stand for the local council, and then will ultimately stand for parliament as well. Or...
So this is the point. Work as a community now to deal with the things that we face every day. So that when it comes to elections, which local elections 2026, you have a community structure that you could have a real hustings.
Right.
Where people who want to stand, one, they would have been involved in community organizing for 18 months or so. Two, they'll have been provided with training on what it means to be a candidate, what it would mean to be a councillor. So they wouldn't go in thinking, oh, yay, this is a chance to make some money. Those people who elected me, who are they again?
Yeah.
So that we could actually have a slate of candidates who come from the community, endorsed by the community, who have a really good sense and have spent time training themselves. And, you know, not all of those who train themselves are going to be nominated to stand, but, you know, that's how democracy works. But hopefully we'd land up with a whole slate of community candidates who will be well-equipped to stand, to make a real difference, to try and wrest control of a council that's been dominated by Labour and special interests for certainly as long as I've lived here. And then, of course, when the next general election happens, and by the way, I don't think we're, whoever it might be, are going to have the pleasure of standing against Keir Starmer again.
Really?
I would be very surprised if he stood again. My instinct already is it's going so badly. He's so bad at politics that, and the next election is going to be tough.
Yeah.
There was a survey out over the weekend that suggested that if an election were held today, Labour would lose well over 100 seats. And I don't think he would be up for a fight.
He doesn't like losing.
Nah. And I don't think he has it in it to do what he'd really need to do to win a proper election.
Yeah.
Not an election in which he's contesting a party that has had Johnson, Truss, Sunak as its last three leaders and prime ministers who, you know, could you find more corrupt, inept people than those three either? I mean, I think you'd be hard pressed. So, you know, effectively an election that was handed to him on a plate. Yeah. I'm not sure he'd be up for a fight. I would hope he would be. Because I think it would be good for us as a community to take him on again in an election.
Shit,
yeah, but I don't think it'll happen. But when there's another general election, depending on that moment in our politics, we'll be in a really good place to identify a great local candidate who's the best person to stand against the major parties at that point. So, yeah, so this community entity we're establishing has a sort of an ongoing role in trying to help communities to take the power that they actually should have, but that has been taken from them.
Right.
But on the other hand, to also contest for that power in an electoral sense.
Right. And also, I mean, I don't know how much you can say about this, but this is happening.
Well, there are some really interesting initiatives taking place around the country. Some of the prominent independents who stood are doing things. I mean, Hove is one area, places like Ilford. Jamie Driscoll, who was the mayor for the Northeast region before he was kicked out of the Labour Party for appearing on a platform with Ken Loach.
Jesus.
Is doing some extraordinary stuff in the northeast of the country, Newcastle and other areas of the northeast. There's stuff going on in Preston and Southport. And I have to tell you, I'm really excited by this because it's, you know, there's not a personality driving this. This is not Jamie Driscoll's movement. This is something called Majority that is being driven by the community.
Yeah.
And Camden is not Andrew Feinstein's movement. It doesn't have a very good ring to it anyway, does it?
It's not the most mellifluous, no.
And You know, this is actually about communities taking charge and getting organized in a way that they haven't. I don't know whether ever or for a long time in this country. And that's the way we build a new political movement. That's the way we go forward to offer people a proper progressive alternative to the nonsense that we have today. And it's an alternative, not just in terms of policies, but in terms of, it's not focused on one or two personalities.
No.
It's focused on communities. And we want communities to own this whole process. And it has to be not just in places like Camden, where you can have these conversations. It has to be places like Clacton.
Yeah. I think it's so profound to say that, yeah.
And, you know, Northampton and places where the left hasn't had a meaningful presence in I don't know how long.
No.
And people we don't talk to.
Yeah.
We say they're this or they're that.
Can't say they're fascist because working class white, you know, whatever, yeah.
I mean, that's a nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, these are people we've got to be talking to.
Yeah.
And yes, it's hard work.
Yeah.
But if we're going to change the functioning and the structure of British politics, it's going to be hard work. That's why they call it struggle. But I'm really up for it. And I think already I'm feeling very excited about what's happening in Camden and in other places. And I think there are an exciting few political years ahead.
Well, we haven't had much reason for hope in the last year or so. So
yeah.
Thank you for giving us that, Andrew. And you know. I'll be there.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. With your very rude poems.
Yes.
Refusing to stand as a candidate.
Oh, and generally being a pain in the ass. Yeah. And, you know, yeah.
You want to talk about the book?
Yeah.
Now let's talk about the book. And part of what I'm doing at the moment is spending a lot of time going around the country, which is giving me access to communities, speaking to communities with this book, Monstrous Anger of the Guns. You can buy it off the Peace and Justice Project website. You can buy it in good bookshops, especially left-wing bookshops, especially independent bookshops, and you can buy it online. And it gives great insight into activism all over the world against the arms trade that is causing the death and destruction we're seeing in Gaza,
yep,
in Lebanon, in Syria, but also the arms trade that is destroying our own politics.
Yes.
And
rots them from the inside.
Yeah. So please do have a read of it. It'll give you and communities you're a part of ideas about how you can campaign, what has been working, what hasn't been working. There are a lot of campaigners from the UK, Palestine Action, Demilitarize Education. And it's a good read. It's a proactive, practical read, which I really like.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll see you out and about.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for inviting me on. It's really good to chat.
Yeah, this is a major, this will put you over the top. This is the major, this podcast is the major power on the left, isn't it? We make or break.
This is what I hear. I was offered the BBC or this. I was told I couldn't do both.
Yeah.
So I went for this, thinking we could have a proper conversation, and I believe this is it.
You chose wisely, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you have? I mean, did they get? And what kind of experience did you have with the legacy media? They did have you on sometimes, didn't they?
So the newspapers, Prospect did an article on my campaign, and then a lot of the alternative media. The Guardian mentioned me once in the entire campaign. And said nothing about my political background, just that I was a South African, not that I'd been an MP, that I'd served under Mandela, et cetera, et cetera. And then the Times actually did a couple of pieces and did a very interesting piece immediately after the election as well, saying that Starmer was probably shocked, not just by the performance of the independents everywhere, but how it affected him very locally around the issue of Palestine and Britain's complicity.
Right.
And that was pretty much it. And the rest of it We knocked on over 50,000 doors. That's how we spoke to people.
That's the best way to do it. Yeah, speak to everybody. Now, the BBC, you know, Newsnight, or BBC News 24 never had you on. Or...
So I was invited on to the BBC World Service to do a whole lot of their news programs. And I can only assume it was because the producer who invited me on must have been so young and new to the job that they forgot about why I hadn't been invited on for years. Because I used to say rude things about Saudi and about our own politicians and defense companies. And the first question I was asked, it was as South Africa was bringing its submission to the International Court of Justice. And I was asked live that I must share the view of South Africa's chief rabbi, which is that the submission is an anti-Semitic screed and a blood libel. So when I had sort of restored my jaw, I said to the journalist who was interviewing me.
He really didn't get the memo.
I said to her, so the Jewish community in South Africa, like the Jewish community everywhere in the world, is fairly diverse and broad. Are you aware that during Mandela's treason trials, a number of the defendants were Jewish, South Africans? But so too was the apartheid state's prosecutor. And that gives you a sense of the breadth of the Jewish community in South Africa. Second of all, with all due respect, the chief rabbinate doesn't have the moral authority to open its mouth about anything at all, because it was only in 1985 that for the first time the rabbinate made this very polite criticism of the system of apartheid. And so therefore, I don't listen to the rabbinate and have no interest in what the chief rabbi has to say. At which point there was just silence. And I wondered whether I was supposed to kick her under the table to remind her that she was supposed to be asking me questions. It was quite weird.
Yeah.
And then I did one more news program where they asked me something very different and said, and then the poor young producer who asked me, who showed me the way out, said to me, we'll be calling on you in the next day or two. And I said, I very much doubt it. And of course, never heard from them again.
Yeah, they definitely hadn't got the memo. Yeah.
Nah. But, you know, this is the world in which we live.
Yeah. You sometimes see somebody on one of those, like, daytime news programs where you think, you're never getting on telly again. Because you say something which is outside. You're supposed to give these pat answers. That you're supposed to, yes, as a Jew, I agree, you know.
But also, it's so deeply anti-Semitic that the assumption is just made that we all think alike. That, oh, they're Jewish, so they only have one uniform brain cell.
Yeah.
And this is what it says.
Israel forever.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.